Before we begin, Mr. Steck, this would be a few minutes early that we're starting since you did send your link to your client. Would you like us to wait until 10:50 to begin?
I don't think that's necessary, Your Honor. I believe he's probably working.
Well, thank you. Well, then, Marshall, will you call the next case?
The next case is in the matter of the children of SLL and MJT, parents, file number A220015.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's May 4th, 2022, and we're hearing arguments this morning on Zoom.gov. This is the second of our oral arguments this morning. We also have four non-orals. The rules here are much as they are in our physical courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would ask you to identify yourselves and who you represent at the beginning of each of your arguments, because we are recording these arguments to post on our website so that others may hear them as well. There is a clock you'll notice in one of our Zoom boxes to help you keep track of that time. And while we have not been experiencing technical difficulties lately, sometimes that happens. So if you experience any, let us know, because we will stop and try and fix it. We want to hear what you have to say. And with that, counsel for appellant, we'll turn to you.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Steck. I'm the attorney for Michael Thomas, the appellant in this matter. A parent that faces a presumptive termination of parental rights has to rebut that presumption before the court proceeds to determine whether or not parental rights have to be terminated absent the presumption. Minnesota Supreme Court has held that in order to be constitutionally valid, that presumption must be easily rebuttable. This case is about what that means. What does it mean to be easily rebuttable? And did the district court violate that standard in this case? We contend that the district court violated that standard in four distinct ways. First, the district court violated the easily rebuttable standard by using the wrong framing for the standard in the first place. In the same opinion where the Minnesota Supreme Court determined that the presumption had to be easily rebuttable, it set forth two different formulations of that standard, stating first that the parent needs to produce evidence that would justify a finding of fact that the parent is not palpably unfit, meaning that the parent has to produce evidence that could justify a finding of fact that the parent is not palpably unfit as defined by the statute, meaning that the parent both has a present inability to parent and that that present inability to parent will persist for the foreseeable future. Those two elements are both essential to the definition of palpable unfitness. The Supreme Court went on, however, to articulate a second formula, saying the parent needs to produce only enough evidence to support a finding that the parent is, present tense, suitable to be entrusted with the care of the children. That means that the parent needs to show a present ability to parent that goes beyond showing that the parent is no longer just palpably unfit, but also that the parent has successfully addressed all issues that would raise any concerns about the ability to parent. Quite simply, the first formulation is easily rebuttable because the parent needs to only show that they have made substantial steps along the journey to a present capacity to parent. The second formulation is not easily rebuttable because the parent must show, in order to meet that burden, that they've traveled the entire journey and have achieved full fitness to parent.
So, Mr. Steck, if I may, I mean, I certainly agree with you that the standard to rebut the presumption of unfitness is lower than the clear and convincing standard. But my main concern here, and I'm looking at page 45 of the district court's order, is after the order states that your client failed to rebut the presumption of palpable unfitness, he said, further, there is clear and convincing evidence to terminate the parental rights. So here, the district court seemed to say, I mean, to find both. And to say that there's clear and convincing evidence to terminate. And so could you address that for me? I mean, are you saying that you know, wasn't before the court, that was, you know, there should have been, like, everything should have stopped after there was that the court should have found that the presumption was overcome and everything should have been put on hold before a second trial? I just would like your perspective on that because I'm struggling with it.
Your Honor, the court, the presumption, once it's overcome, has no further bearing on the case. Okay, so what that means is that the court can't simply mush the issues together and address them both at the same time. It rather must undertake two separate analyses in order to ensure that there is a proper analysis of each standard. First, it has to determine whether the presumption has been overcome or not. It does then reset its analysis to the beginning because the burden shifts then to the petitioner to show clear and convincing evidence. Okay, merely saying, well, there was also clear and convincing evidence to support termination doesn't supply the underlying analysis on whether the presumption was overcome in the first place, and then a separate analysis using different standards on whether there's clear and convincing evidence. The only way for this court, frankly, to review would be for the district court to have done two separate analyses. Otherwise, the district court's being allowed, in essence, to use magic words here. It can just say, well, there's also clear and convincing evidence, so I don't need to conduct these separate analyses.
Let me interrupt for a minute. Is it really that simple? I mean, couldn't the district court, even if we agree with you as to the court erring on the issue of the presumption, couldn't the district court still, and in fact did, find clear and convincing evidence that supports the conclusion that your client was palpably unfit?
The district court said those words, but I don't think the district court found the clear and convincing evidence. And that gets to my second way in which the easily rebuttable standard was violated here, because the district court shifted the burden of proof. Look at the underlying analysis in the district court's lengthy order. And I know that this court often refers to the length of the order to establish how well-reasoned it is. But in this case, it's a lengthy order because the same mistake keeps getting made over and over and over again. And what that is a focus not on what the county proved, but on what Mr. Thomas failed to prove.
Let me stop you for a minute. I understand your argument that these are kind of mushed together here, but the evidence to show that he is palpably unfit to meet the clear and convincing standard on behalf of the petitioner is going to be some of the same evidence discussed, maybe in error, when your discussion is made about the presumption. But let's just say we agree with you as to the presumption. It still seems to me in these findings we can get to the issue of clear and convincing evidence of palpable unfitness. And you're saying we can't?
We could have, if the district court had applied that standard correctly. See, the main reason that it has to be split into two parts is because the first part asks the question of what has Mr. Thomas produced? Okay, so that's his burden of production. The second one then, if the presumption's overcome, then we can assess whether there's clear and convincing evidence. But at that point, the focus needs to shift, no longer to focus on what Mr. Thomas has produced, but rather to focus on what the county has produced, because it bears the burden to show clear and convincing evidence. In this case, the district court's order, even though it says there's clear and convincing evidence, at no point does it focus on what the county proved. It merely focuses on what Mr. Thomas failed to prove. He failed to prove enough change. He failed to prove that he's got a present ability to parent. It never focuses on what the county had to prove, which is not only that his prior termination was, as the district court noted, horrendous, but that continues in the present, and that it would continue for the foreseeable future.
The district court does make some findings about that. I mean, it says, talks about your client's mental health issues. They're going to take significant time to address. And, you know, talks about the ability to safely care for his children in the reasonably foreseeable future. I mean, those are the types of findings that we usually often see, you know, where a court is addressing the clear and convincing evidence standard.
I would say those are the words the court often sees, but that these findings are merely the phrasing is there, but the analysis is not. So the district court, for example, with regard to my client's mental health, right? The district court said, well, his mental health isn't in a position to and won't be for the foreseeable future so that he's safe to parent. But what is the evidence that the district court is pointing to for that finding? Does it refer to anything in the present day? Does it show any behavior by Mr. Thomas in the present day that indicates that he has mental health problems in the present that make him a danger to parent. No evidence of that kind was presented. It was all about, well, he had these serious mental health problems in the past. We don't think that he's gained enough insight, which is sort of another magic word test, so of that he hasn't admitted to everything that we want him to admit to. So we're going to just say he must be unfit because he's never addressed the past. See, what that happened there is that it just shifted the burden again. The county didn't have to show anything except for that there was a big problem in the past. The burden then shifted to Mr. Thomas to show that he had changed enough so that the past no longer apply. The burden of proof was placed on Thomas.
Mr. Steck, let me ask you. I mean, I understand, again, your argument. But when you get to such issues such as past physical abuse of children, which is evident here, the state brings in, say, the past, in this past, physical abuse of children. But isn't the argument going to be made that that can add to the clear and convincing evidence of palpable unfitness even at a later date because of the danger of further physical abuse?
It raises a concern. It doesn't constitute proof. Okay, we don't want to get in a situation where, because remember, the standard has to be easily rebuttable. And then the county bears the burden and the presumption bears no further relationship. What that analysis, with respect, Your Honor, does bring the presumption back in. It says, well, because we found it in the past, we're going to infer that it will continue in the future unless he shows it won't. By bringing that presumption back, it shifts the burden.
Well, let me turn it around. Are you saying it's no longer relevant evidence?
It's relevant evidence for the concern that you're looking at in the present. In other words, what you're doing is you're saying, okay, we need to look at the present and we need to say, is there any behavior in the present, not speculations about what might be behavior based on the past, but is there any concrete evidence in the now that indicates that this is still a problem? That's what's absent from the district court's order. There's no concrete proven behavior in the present to support the inference that the past problems might recur. It's simply, well, they're so horrible that we can't take the risk. That's what the testimony that was elicited at trial was, and that's what the reasoning is in the district court's order. It's saying, Mr. Thomas hasn't shown that it won't recur, so we're going to assume that it might. That's not putting the burden in the right place, which is on the county. Indeed, this focus on the past conduct produces, in essence, an impossible burden for anyone that faces a statutory presumption, because they have to prove the negative. They have to prove not only that they've taken steps in Mr. Thomas's case to address his mental health, but he has to prove that somehow he has to prove those steps were so successful that the court doesn't even need to worry about anything in the future.
Counsel, if I may, I saw the court's concern, well, or at least reflected in the experts and the county's workers, is that your client didn't acknowledge the problems in the past. And unless you acknowledge those, how are you going to work to make sure that they don't happen again? I mean, sir, could you address that line of reasoning for me? Because that's where I see the past being particularly relevant.
And this gets to the problem of what do we mean by insight, right? The development of insight is often thrown about as a necessary condition. And to a degree, certainly that's true, right? Somebody has to recognize that they had a problem. It doesn't mean, however, that they have to acknowledge every single prior allegation as true, merely that they have to acknowledge the issues that had to be addressed, okay? The district court here insisted that if he didn't acknowledge every prior allegation as true, including the ones that weren't even adjudicated from Arizona, he had to acknowledge them all as being true or else he didn't have insight. That's the wrong standard. What he has to acknowledge in order to have insight is, do I have a problem? And what can I do to address it? Mr. Thomas did that. He said, I had anger management problems in the past. I've addressed that. The testimony of Ms. Lofgren, his partner, also supported that. She said, I read the reports, and I compared them to the person that I've observed in my years-long relationship with him, and they weren't the same person. Okay? That's indication that there has been a change in Mr. Thomas's behavior. To require, however, that he disprove everything in the past possibly ever existing again shifts the burden to him and makes the standard impossible to ever rebut. The last point that I'd like to address is the bias.
Counsel, I'm sorry. I know you're running out of time, but I have to. Is it the presumption that makes him have to explain himself, or is it his past behavior that makes him have to explain himself? In other words, forget the presumption for a minute. Now you come in having acknowledged termination on those five kids way back when, and aren't you going to have to explain yourself given what went on before, even with honor presumption?
You're going to have, the question is how far you have to explain yourself. Certainly you do have to explain yourself, but do you have to explain yourself to the point of proving that I will never do this again and I can absolutely prove that to a certainty? No, that's not an unreasonable burden, because the burden is supposed to be on the county to prove by clear and convincing evidence that it will happen again. Okay. What Mr. Thomas does have to explain is I've taken substantial steps so far that gets me past the presumption, and then I could succeed on a case plan. We're not talking immediate reunification here. We're talking about should Mr. Thomas have been given the option to go on a case plan and given the opportunity to perform? He wasn't given that option, but he expressed consistently a strong willingness to do so, and he showed it by engaging in services.
Further questions from the panel? Thank you. I'll have additional time for rebuttal. Counsel Respondent, we'll turn to you.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. My name is John Bowen, and I represent Respondent Wright County Health and Human Services. The district court here did not err when it concluded that appellant failed to rebut the statutory presumption and concluded also that appellant was palpably unfit. Appellant has a history here of violence against children that led to his 2013 termination and his conviction for felony malicious punishment of a child. He inflicted numerous injuries upon multiple children, that included fractures and injuries to the children's eyes and genitals. Now, during that 2013 juvenile protection matter, appellant underwent a psychological evaluation. That's Exhibit 33. And in that evaluation, the evaluator discussed his mental health history and his inability to take responsibility for his conduct. In that assessment, it recommended several mental health services for appellant. It really, in essence, laid out a framework for appellant to begin to take the steps to address his history of abuse and his mental health issues. And notably, in that assessment, it recommends dialectical behavioral therapy and individual therapy. Now, appellant had 8 years from 2013 to 2021 to take responsibility to start to address his issues, and he failed to do so.
Counsel, before we get into more of the facts here, I would appreciate your helping me understand how this TBR trial was set up. I mean, so here, the district court says, well, that appellant failed to rebut the presumption and then went on to say there's clear and convincing evidence. I mean, is that the way the county presented it? I want to understand, and were there objections to that presentation, if that's the way the county proposed to proceed? Could you help me with that?
Well, yeah. The way I understand, I was not the trial court counsel, but in reviewing the exhibits and reviewing, the record, the exhibits, and I believe there were about 36 exhibits, they were stipulated to by the parties. So they were really, everything was presented all at once to the trial court.
On both grounds. That's what I just want to be really clear about.
Yes, Sharon, on both grounds, yes.
Sharon. And if I go, on both the presumption ground and the clear and convincing, it was alternative grounds. Was there objection to that?
No.
I mean, the reason I ask, and this is what one of my major concerns here is, if someone, just stepping back from this, just in general, if it meets the burden to overcome the presumption, then the question in my mind is, wouldn't that individual be entitled to kind of reasonable efforts to reunify, and that, the county needs to, isn't there an argument? Well, then the county should come in, because before that, the county's been relieved of reasonable efforts because this possibility of the statutory presumption. The statutory presumption is rebutted, then isn't it a reasonable assumption that things should be on reset and at least the county should be stepping in to provide reasonable efforts? That's my, and he would have the opportunity to have that case plan. That's my concern here and why I'm want to understand more about how this trial would set up. So could you help it?
Well, I'm not sure if I'm answering correctly, but the way I understand it is that Your Honor, if you could just repeat that really quickly for me, actually, just the last part of that.
I'm trying to understand the interplay with the obligation to present reasonable efforts and rebutting the presumption. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Thank you for clarifying. Well, first of all, this is a statutory creation. 260.012 is the reasonable effort statute. 260C.301 and following lay out the procedures here. There really is no statutory framework for providing or requirement to provide reasonable efforts after the question of the presumption has been resolved. So there really is no requirement in any case law or any statute that would require reasonable efforts to then be reactivated, then thus triggering the requirement under 260C.212 sub 2 for a out-of-home placement plan or a child protective services case plan. So there really is no requirement under the law as it currently sits to require reasonable efforts.
Law is just not saying one way or the other. Isn't that? And that, which is why I'm asking you, was this discussed by either party or raised before the district court?
Well, it was. Well, appellant did raise at the district court the issue of requesting a case plan. But really, when you're looking at the questions that are presented to the trial court, the first question is, there's been a petition that's been presented. The petition outlines statutory grounds. And at that point, the first question for the trial court is, first of all, was the burden met or was the burden of production met? Then is the overall burden by the county met as far as best interests and the statutory ground? Then that's the initial question for the court. The court, and as Mr. Steck did point out, I believe in the trial court closing argument, the trial court does have an alternative ability after deciding whether a termination is appropriate or not to offer a case plan to essentially create a CHIPS case, essentially. And that's 260C312. The court didn't do that here. So that initial inquiry was done. There was no need to do a further inquiry at that point.
Okay, Mr. Bowen, I have a question. Let's just presume for purposes of argument this morning that we feel there was enough to rebut the presumption, which would seem to indicate that the father had taken some steps, enough at least to rebut the presumption. So as your counsel suggests, your opponent, then the burden would shift to the petitioner to show by clear and convincing evidence palpable unfitness. Given that there's been some evidence that he's moved forward enough to rebut the presumption, this is kind of where the confusion comes in because the district court seemed to kind of merge this. So if the district court didn't acknowledge the evidence that he did enough to rebut the presumption, show us where the state was able to show by clear and convincing evidence that he was palpably unfit, even given the steps he had taken to rebut the presumption. Do you understand?
I do understand. There's plenty of evidence in the record. So assuming that he does rebut the presumption here, there's still plenty of evidence to demonstrate that he failed to take the necessary steps since 2013 to address his mental health issues. He goes and he gets a diagnostic assessment. He gets a parenting assessment. In those assessments, both of those assessments, he denies responsibility for his actions. In fact, when they even give him psychological testing, he basically doesn't answer the questions in a valid format. So there is really no way to determine whether he's addressed those or not because he's basically being untruthful in his assessment. So There is plenty of evidence in the record that he is not taking responsibility for his past conduct, that these conditions would continue because he hasn't addressed his mental health issues. Yes, maybe he takes some steps at the 11th hour to engage in therapy, get these assessments. But the district court says, just even assuming that, assuming all those things are true, assuming that he has taken certain steps, the district court says, and I could find this specific citation to it in here. It would be paragraph 116 of the conclusions of law. And it says that basically his efforts would only begin to scratch the surface of the years of abuse that he had perpetrated and experienced. So even assuming that the presumption was rebutted, there was still plenty of evidence in the record to demonstrate that he did not take responsibility, that he continued to blame others, and that he hadn't really adequately addressed his mental health issues. So there would be clear and convincing evidence. I do understand that the analysis is merged, that the exhibits are presented as a stipulated format. So I can see, it doesn't appear to be a discrete step-by-step analysis. Yet when this court is looking at it de novo, the court can examine the record and make a determination that he did not rebut that presumption, and that the county did, in the ultimate conclusion, prove by clear and convincing evidence that appellant is palpably unfit. I just want to just discuss appellant's argument or statement that there was no concrete behavior in the present. I think I did address that. That would be his failure to take into account or to accept responsibility for his past behavior. Appellant's counsel makes issue of the fact of insight. Says that we are essentially looking only at past allegations and not the present, but it really is important to look at the past. The trial court, this court, have to have an understanding of what led to that termination of parental rights to determine whether he corrected the conditions. That's in the JBM decision. JBM, an unpublished case, though, says it would be impossible for the district court to assess whether a parent had rebutted without looking at that past. And that's what the district court did here. It looked at the Carver County order. Those made extensive findings regarding his history of abuse. This is not a reliance solely on past history. These are adjudicated facts in a prior termination proceeding. The district court here found it particularly relevant that appellant continued to minimize, continued to deny, blame his ex-partner, blame these were accidental injuries. In every single way, he's denying his past history. In his own brief at page 30, I would just add that appellant isn't asking for reunification. He's not asking, he's admitting tacitly that he's not able to parent. But that's not the question before the district court. That's not the question before the trial or before the court of appeals. The question is that threshold question, whether he's rebutted the presumption and whether the county has met its overall burden. Appellant's argument also fails to acknowledge that the county was relieved of reasonable efforts, as I mentioned earlier.
And on that front, I just want to make sure I'm on the same page. You would read Minnesota Statute 260.012A2, which requires reasonable efforts except upon a determination by the court that a petition, the prima facie case language, prima facie case that the parental rights of the parent to another child have been terminated involuntarily. So I just want to make sure your reading of that I understand. From your perspective, that statute relieves the county of reasonable efforts, regardless about whether the presumption is overcome or not.
That's correct. That is correct. And I believe that language is again reiterated in 260C. And I believe it's 301. And I can't remember if it's subdivision 7 or subdivision 8 of that statute. But it would be subdivision 8. And subdivision 8 even addresses that and says that reasonable efforts are required unless. And so it actually also cross-references 260.012.
And there was no constitutional challenge to the application of that statute, right? Here in this case, as I understand it, correct? I just want to make sure I understand the record.
There was I'd have to go back and look at Mr. Steck's closing argument. I believe that in the motion for new trial, at least there was a mention of the constitutionality of the statute, but the new trial motion was denied. I just want to talk about best interests just very briefly. All of this conversation and discussion about past history and how much that factors in, I would just like to note for the court that when the court is assessing best interests, when it's assessing the facts for best interests, it really is required to look at all relevant factors, not just the factors that are outlined in 260C212, but all relevant factors. That's the mandate of 260C.511 subdivision A. Appellant's history of violence against children would certainly be highly relevant in the court's analysis. Ultimately, Your Honors, this is a case where appellant's children in his care were beaten. They were injured. He failed to address his history of violence. He failed to take responsibility for his actions, and he failed to rebut the statutory presumption. Respondent Wright County would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court order terminating his parental rights. And unless the court has any other questions, I would respectfully yield the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Are there further questions in the panel? Thank you, Mr. Bowen. Mr. Steck, we'll turn to you for the last word. I believe you're muted.
I'd like to make 3 points with regard to the questions that the court posed to respondents' counsel. First, though, having to do with were there any objections? Mr. Bowen's correct that there were stipulations as to the admissibility of the exhibits, and that's quite simply because there's case law that establishes that the contents of social services files can be admitted straight up as part of the district court record in this case. But what was not stipulated was the way in which those exhibits could be used. Mr. Thomas consistently objected to the use of those exhibits to try and somehow infer that because something bad happened in the past, that it's assumed to be recurring in the future, absent his proof to the contrary. And that's the way it was used, and he consistently objected to that. Secondly, I'd like to address the court's question regarding to Mr. Bowen regarding what was the county's evidence of present palpable unfitness. What was the county's clear and convincing evidence? And I'd like the court to very carefully note what Mr. Bowen said. He said that Mr. Thomas failed to take the necessary steps. That was the county's evidence. That shifts the burden. He's putting the burden on Mr. Thomas to show that he took the necessary steps, not putting the burden on the county to show that there is present day conduct, not words, conduct that shows an inability to parent. Look at what the definition of palpable unfitness is. It says—
Counsel, let me interrupt for a minute. I understand your point, but how does one show the likelihood of further abuse? I mean, just because someone has stopped, does that mean they'll never abuse again? I mean, you have to show that the children are in danger right now. And how do you do that? How would the county do that?
Well, normally it's done with some finding of present abuse. In this case, the only evidence that he was even offered was offered by Mr. Thomas, and that was the testimony of Ms. Lofgren about what his parenting behavior was. The county had plenty of opportunity to provide parenting opportunities. It was requested consistently by Mr. Thomas that he be provided supervised parenting time, and the county opposed that. All they had to do was allow him the parenting time and observe and see what he does.
Well, that still would be supervised parenting time, and parents are often on their best behavior then. But I guess my point is that if there's a history of abuse based in part on mental health problems, and steps are not taken to address that, I understand you might object to that, but if steps are not taken to address the mental health issues that led in part to the abuse, how is that shifting the burden to point that out? I mean, you understand what I'm saying? If you don't take the steps, that's not present signs of abuse, but you haven't taken all the necessary steps to make it less likely.
But again, that would bring the presumption back in, first of all. But my main objection there is to say the standard there needs to be not whether he's taken all the current steps, but whether or not he's taken enough steps to bring it within the foreseeable future that he could succeed. And look at the testimony of Dr. Marshall, who was a county witness and the county's only expert witness. She's the only one that gave an opinion on timeline. And she said within 2 to 3 months, we could see progress, or at least we'd know one way or the other. That's within the foreseeable future. The county's own expert is saying that. So he should have been given the opportunity to be put on a case plan.
Dr. Marshall also recommended termination, didn't she?
But when she was, the only choices that she was addressing was the dichotomy between immediate reunification and termination. She wasn't addressing, should there be a case plan on this? She was treating this like a normal TPR case, not a presumptive termination case, which asks different questions. And I established that with her on cross-examination if the court wants to look at the transcript. I'd lastly like to address Mr. Bowen's point about best interest, because he's saying, well, look, the court's got to be able to consider past history. If the court can use past history and the danger posed by it to say that it is in the best interest of the children to terminate, then overcoming the presumption would just be meaningless, because it just comes right back through best interest. It comes in through the back door. Okay. Best interest needs to be looked at again according to the present behavior and conduct of the parent. That's what the definition of palpable unfitness says. Conduct, not words. Not did the parent genuflect and show their capacity to accept what happened before. And also I'd note on best interest that what the court's finding on best interest here was perverse. It said, it terminated the relationship at the outset of the proceedings and then said, well, since we've terminated the relationship, the children no longer have any interest in a continuing relationship. The best interest calculation was very twisted here.
Can I ask a question? I know we're over time here. Mr. Stack, real quickly, your comment on the guardian's recommendation. Guardian ad litem.
The guardian's recommendation was entirely 100% based upon past conduct. She did a 12-minute conversation with Mr. Thomas, and that was it. She did no independent investigation. She read what was spoon-fed to her, informed her opinion, and closed her mind.
Are there further questions from the panel? Seeing none, the court thanks you both for these helpful arguments in a challenging case.